Do you want to support This Day in Miami History? Do you want cool swag? Well, visit thisdaymiamipod.com and check out our shop. You can find the link at the top of the page. There's a new item this month specifically related to the episode you're about to listen to on Interama. I hope you like it, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to say, ahoy, or land ho, and not feel weird about it. So here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance offers access to the largest towing fleet on the water. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to say, shiver me timbers, and not feel weird about that either. Get more with GEICO.
As a state, Florida is not generally seen as a bulwark of the labor movement. In fact, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in 2024, only 12 other states in the United States have a lower percentage of union members in their workforce. Even more than that, Florida was the first state in the United States to have a right-to-work provision added to its laws. In fact, it's in the state's constitution as of 1944. Article 1, Section 6, the right of persons to work shall not be denied or abridged on account of membership or non-membership in any labor union or labor organization. The idea of, quote, right-to-work laws, found in Florida Statutes, Chapter 447, Part 1, are designed to weaken labor unions' influence, as members of the workforce can benefit from union collective bargaining without actually paying a dues membership. Florida helped set the attitude of the Deep South, which is generally the least supportive region of labor unions in the United States. There's something else in Article 1, Section 6 of the Florida Constitution, though. The last sentence. Public employees shall not have the right to strike. And that will be the story of our episode today. When the teachers of the state of Florida, with strong leadership from Dade County, decided to work around that particular sentence as best they could and organize a walkout, what came to be known as the Florida Teachers Strike of 1968. Again, that's our topic today. This day in Miami history, February 19th, 1968, when the Dade County Classroom Teachers Association and other teacher organizations in the state submitted their resignations en masse.
The high times, the low times, all in the nightlife.
The organized walkout didn't start in 1968. It was an evolved process, a building up of anger that took weeks and months beforehand. But the catalyzing event really was the election of Governor Claude Kirk in 1966. We're going to talk about all these things in just a moment with Georgia State University lecturer Jody Baxter Knoll, who's the author of the upcoming book, The 1968 Florida Teacher Strike, Public Sector Unionism and the Fight Against Sunshine State Conservatism. It's part of the Making the Modern South series from LSU Press. But I want to set the context a little bit to help you understand that this was not just a spur-of-the-moment decision. In fact, a walk-off had been organized in Broward County months before the formal walk-off in February 1968. The reason was not really overpay. That was an issue, but not the issue. The real issue for teachers in Florida was the conditions of the schools that they were working in. Here are a few teachers from Broward County speaking to a WTVJ reporter about what motivated them to submit their resignations.
The conditions are what are bothering me, really. How about you, David? What was your reason?
The conditions are bothering me, too, particularly the textbooks. When I came here, I'm from Kentucky, and I had the impression that Florida would be a well-equipped school system. I find that the school in which we're teaching is a collection of barracks from World War II vintage.
I just feel that teaching conditions in Broward County, as far as class size and lack of supplies, materials, textbooks, teaching loads get greater every year, and we just feel that this is the time to change this condition.
That labor effort was enjoined by a state court as violating the provision in the Constitution of Florida that prohibited public sector union strikes. And so the Classroom Teachers Associations of Florida, alongside the Florida Educators Association and the American Federation for Teachers, realized that larger numbers would be needed in order to prove their point to the state. That sets up our conversation now. Again, we'll be speaking with author and Georgia State University history lecturer Jody Baxter Knoll about his upcoming book for pre-order now and available next month, The 1968 Florida Teacher Strike, Public Sector Unionism, and the Fight Against Sunshine State Conservatism. Here's our discussion with Jody Baxter Knoll. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining with us today. I have a very special guest I'm really pleased to talk to about the Florida teacher strike of 1968, a really significant moment in the state's history as it relates to its education and its labor practices. And that special guest is Jody Baxter Knoll. He's a lecturer in history at Georgia State University, but he is a Florida man hailing from the Sunshine State. And so we're very honored to talk to him today and specifically about his new book that's not even out yet, but you're going to be able to pre-order it and get it in your hands in the next couple of days or weeks, and you'll be able to find that link on our social media and in the description of this show. The book is The 1968 Florida Teacher Strike, Public Sector Unionism, and the Fight Against Sunshine State Conservatism. That book is part of LSU Press's Making the Modern South series, and the author, last but not least, first in importance today, is Jody Baxter Knoll. Jody, how you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Me as well. I'm really looking forward to it. So first things first, let's talk a little bit about the state of Florida. And Dade plays a significant role in all this, and we're going to get into Dade's role a little bit later. But let's talk about a broader look in the state of Florida in the mid-60s. Florida is undergoing a variety of changing forces. One of them is a massive increase in the number of kind of engineering workers in the mid part of the state because of the space program. You're looking at the post-war boom of movement into the state. It's really changing the political and social environment. Would you care to talk to us a little bit how we get from, you know, not to set you up a little bit, from the pork chop gang into a governor like Claude Kirk?
Yeah. I think there's, like you said, there's a lot of things at play in the 1960s in Florida and in the country as well. And Florida, I think, is a really good microcosm of the country. And so what's occurring is Florida is like every other southern state at this point. It is controlled in the early 60s by the Democratic Party. They have, up until the late 1940s, a closed primary system that is not allowing anybody but whites to vote in that primary system. And it is controlled not just by the Democratic Party, but a group of Democrats, rural Democrats known as the Pork Chop Gang. So Florida is malapportioned, which means that most of the legislature is actually coming from the least populated aspects of the state. And again, when we're talking about the Democratic Party, it's important to understand that you have the liberal progressive wing of the Democratic Party that is in areas such as Miami and Dade County at this point, but you have a rural conservative Democratic Party that's occurring like in the Panhandle, North Central Florida, and those areas as well, that will eventually become the modern Republican Party. This has the long lineage of the Republican Party in the South during the Civil War. But as the Pork Chop Gang is controlling through malapportionment, right? So having more of their people in positions of legislative power because of malapportionment, you're also beginning to see this massive population boom. And it's bringing Northerners and Midwesterners of all different economic classes, but really kind of a professional class to the state of Florida. They're coming for, low taxes, sunshine, those things, but also the development of the Space Coast, and these kind of engineering things, engineering fields. And as they're coming, many of them, like what I've found, is that many of them are conservative, but are Republican-minded conservatives. And so as the Porkchop Gang has this power, you have the liberal urban Democrats who are pushing against the Porkchop Gang's power. And then you have these Republican transplants coming from the Midwest and the North who are also seeking to disrupt the power of the Porkchop Gang because they're moving to places such as the Space Coast, Orlando, Brevard County, Space Coast, and Broward County as well in South Florida. And with that, they're saying that we don't want, the fewest populated areas of the state to have this much political control. And so this actually leads to the election of Republican Governor Claude Kirk, who is the first Republican governor elected in Florida and in the Deep South since Reconstruction. And Kirk is a salesman first, a businessman second, and a politician third. He has very little political experience, but he sells his vision to make Florida the best state in the country. And one of those plans is to what he keeps saying, because he also recognizes that if we're going to keep bringing these transplants down, we need to have a good education system. And so he says we're going to make education first in the country. But he also says that we're going to do this without raising funding and without raising taxes, which to the teachers is an abject failure. Like that, it's a plan that is dead on arrival, because with this massive population boom, you also have new students, right? And so they're dealing with overcrowded classrooms, they're dealing with failing school infrastructure, schools are falling apart, they're demanding things, simple things such as air conditioning in their classrooms, up-to-date textbooks, stuff that I think we kind of take for granted, but they're saying we have to have this stuff. And so when Kirk takes power, it's really this kind of political transformation of Florida that opens the door for the Republican Party to come in. And Kirk wants to implement the ideas of business efficiency, what I refer to as entrepreneurial governance, and basically say we don't need to raise funding or taxes because we're going to make sure education and the government is going to be much more efficient. And so this almost immediately leads to a confrontation with the teachers.
I want to backtrack just a moment and then come to that confrontation with Governor Kirk, because the gubernatorial election in 66 that leads to Claude Kirk's election is kind of unusual, and it reflects some of those political currents that you were alluding to, because the Democratic primary is the first in this kind of new age of better apportionment. The 60s kind of reforms of voting rights are occurring, and the Democratic primary and the Democratic Party, which had basically had a lockhold on the state of Florida, has a really bruising primary that kind of reflects that, I think, that more conservative Democratic lean in Hayden Burns against a Miamian, Robert King High, who's basically a kind of a modern Democrat, a desegregationist Democrat coming from South Florida, a very different in political environment at that time and still. How much do you think that split in the Democratic Party or that weakening in the Democratic Party contributes to the soon-to-be governor, Claude Kirk, feeling like he can take this attitude towards education?
Yeah, I think it's a big thing, right? Because what it's doing is showing the fractures of the Democratic Party. And it also means that once High defeats Burns, and Burns is actually the incumbent governor, once High defeats Burns, you can see that these rural Democrats in areas such as Pensacola, Taylor County, are going to push back. And they're not necessarily going to throw all of their support behind High, who does have a very progressive message. He's what we would consider today, a traditional Democrat, and like kind of modern political standards before this switch happens. And so that does play a large role in it, right? And Burns never actually endorses High, and so this is going to play a large role in all of this. But I think, you have that, but then the population boom really plays a role as well. So it's these two factors that are combining to lead to Kirk, because Kirk, while I think he's a rather ineffectual governor, he does do a very good job of selling himself. And he does do a very good job of trying to get people to understand that Florida is in a transitional period and that they need somebody, and his argument is a political outsider, to bring Florida up to modern standards. And with that comes education. And I think the other important thing to understand is that even before Kirk's election, education is failing. The National Education Association, the NEA, comes in 1965 and says that education in Florida is a complete and total disaster. There's too much politics behind it. Teachers have no power. Funding is just a funding is at a really kind of low period. There's clear needs for increased funding, increased classrooms, increased teachers. And so all of this is kind of all working together in conjunction with each other. So I would say it's the primary, but it's also Kirk's ability to sell his vision to the state. And then in terms of education, it's important to understand that by 1965, the National Education Association is already stepping in and saying that education in Florida has to be fixed. And one of the only ways that it's going to be fixed is to increase funding towards it.
So Claude Kirk enters Governor's Mansion in Tallahassee with this problem. And I think, again, the fact that you're bringing this up, it was a known problem. It wasn't something that just happened to fall out of the sky. One of the reasons why he is bringing up the issue of education and wanting to improve it is because it is this kind of bubbling pot in the state that most folks are aware of. But this split attitude of we're going to make education the best in the country and also not increase the tax revenue to support it leads to some questions. And these are questions that are asked in the mid-60s and in the state of Florida. And now I will mention, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a Miami-Dade County public school teacher. I'm also a member of United Teachers of Dade, which is the teachers union here in Dade County. So I would say that those questions continue to echo in the 2020s of attempting to improve an education system without actually putting the revenues necessary to make it happen. But so Clark drops this plan, and the union representatives in the state of Florida, in Dade and Hillsborough and elsewhere, are doing the proverbial math and seeing, well, how do you plan on doing that? And the answer is drive your teachers harder, ask them to do more with less, and basically tell them good luck and do it for the good of the kids. And this appears to be a breaking point for not only union leadership, but a significant number of educators in Florida. If you can tell us a little bit about what that process looks like after Kirk kind of drops his plan, and why do you think this was the breaking point?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that are happening. One is a changing demographic in teachers. You're getting younger teachers who have experience or have been exposed to the social movements of the 1960s, the civil rights movement, students' rights movement, anti-war movements. And so I think they're being influenced by that a little bit. You do have a little bit more of a male workforce entering into the teaching ranks, but it's still a dominantly woman-led workforce, which I think is important because there's this atmosphere of teacher militancy that's occurring throughout the country at this time period. And a lot of the explanations for it at the time were, well, more men are entering the workforce and they're saying that this isn't appropriate. But really, I would say that women are helping to lead this, right? That it's a frustration of this. And so as that's occurring, Kirk's plans just don't resonate because it's his what teachers are demanding at this point, and it's what Albert Shanker, who's the famed union president of the American Federation of Teachers and the Classroom Teachers Association, I think. What he refers to as teacher power. And it's this idea that teachers, in order for teachers to effectively teach their job, one, they need to be a professional salary that reflects their expertise. Because what they're saying is that teachers are not caretakers, right? This kind of very gendered notion of teaching as a motherly profession, where you're just basically babysitters or caretakers of these children. What the teachers are saying is, no, we're highly qualified professionals with college degrees who are here to educate the children. Yes, of course we love the children, and yes, we do get compensated. This idea of emotional compensation from this, but we want to be paid like highly qualified professionals. But for the Florida teachers, it's even bigger than that, because, and I would say teachers around the country, because what they're saying is, in order to fix education in this country, in order for us to have a successful education, we need to have more autonomy in the classrooms. We need teachers to be able to help these reform efforts and help lead these educational reform efforts, which I think is something that is still very salient today. Kirk, on the other hand, is the opposite. Kirk's plan, again, which I think is salient today, which you see with kind of ideas of business efficiency within governance, and you can see it like at its highest level right now with the Dodge program,
Yeah.
and Elon Musk, is that the only people who can fix this are business people, right? That education in Florida is wildly inefficient. We're throwing just waste. We're just throwing dead money, bad money at bad money, and it's just not getting good. So instead of giving teachers more autonomy, giving them more power, giving them more say over their profession and over their expertise, Kirk says we need business leaders in this position. They will find it, because education is an investment. And for Kirk, I think the problem is that, it's an investment, but you can't actually see the returns on the investments for 20, 30 years. So he's just saying we have to cut and slash. If we cut and slash towards computers, as the future of education is with computers, teachers won't teach, they'll just help students use computers, which is very, very early for this, right in the 1960s. But I think he's kind of seen technology as a way to do this. Says that teachers have way too much power already, because they have continuing contracts or teacher tenure, so he wants to strip that away. He says they have no accountability, so he's trying to implement ideas of merit pay. Again, all really early for what now I think is commonplace for the education reform movement. But Kirk is trying to do all of these things, but they're directly conflicting with the experts, and the experts are the teachers. The other thing that I think is really important to understand about this is Kirk, and anytime you have instances of teacher militancy, even today, the rationale behind them, or the way people quickly point to the union and say the union is pushing their members to be more militant, and they're the ones who are doing this, and like they're the ones who are pushing this. The teachers don't actually want this. The reality is it's the opposite. The teachers are the ones, the union, the FEA, which is a teacher organization at the time, the FEA, Classroom Teachers Association of Dade, which becomes United Teachers, all of these local affiliates are actually, these union officials are saying, we need to be cautious. We don't need to go on strike. This is not what the NEA does. This is not what the FEA does. They're giving this message of caution, right? Like, let's be a professional organization. And the teachers are saying, no, the time is done. We have tried this for years and years, for decades, and it is not resonating. It is not working. And so we want to be more militant. And so I think that is a really important thing to understand when you're talking about teacher militancy at large, is that it's almost always not the union, but the teachers who are pushing for militancy in order to improve their professional lives and education as a whole.
Sure. Yeah. So I think when you look at the events that kind of lead up to this moment, it's a thousand paper cuts of small indignities or small questionings of the professionality of the educators who are doing the daily work. And again, might have my biases here, but at some point, the last one becomes the last one, where you just can't stand it anymore. And I think that the event that happens in the Tangerine Bowl in Orlando is such a testament to the fact that this is very much a bottom-up movement, where you have such a high percentage of the educators from across the state of Florida coming together for a meeting to do something about this in a literal football stadium. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that meeting represents, what happens there, and like you were alluding to a second ago, how this kind of reflects the popular will of teachers across the state?
So just a little bit of background. The Tangerine Bowl meeting happens in August of 1967. And 1967 is what is referred to as the education crisis of 1967. Kirk has been in office basically since January of 67, and education is, at the forefront of his governancy, as well as people's, the public's minds as well, because they all recognize that education isn't working well. And so there's a lot of back and forth dialogue in the at 1967 of what are we going to do to improve education? Kirk actually gives the teachers a raise because he thinks that that's going to appease the teachers. I think it shows that he fundamentally misunderstands what the teachers are actually demanding, because they are demanding to be able to have the tools in order to be effective teachers. They're not just demanding pay. And so there's a lot of back and forth. The NEA ends up placing sanctions around the state that say that, notifying business leaders, telling business leaders around the country, you don't want to move to this state. You don't want to move your companies to this state, because if you do, your children, the children of your workers, are not going to have a good education system. So this immediately sets the business leaders off, who are saying, well, we got to fix something. And so as all of this is happening, it just seems Kirk is not listening. Kirk is a very confrontational governor and politician. His idea is basically to bully and bulldoze his way through everything, and he'll be able to kind of create this hyper masculine image of, like, he's not going to allow anybody to push him around. Okay. With also the understanding that Kirk is incredibly anti-union, and Florida itself is anti-union. It's the first state to enact right to work laws and anti-union laws in the 1940s. And so as this is all happening, teachers are pushing more and more. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they come to the conclusion that they're going to hold a rally in August 1967, known as the Tangerine Bowl meeting, which is in Orlando, Florida. And roughly 27,000 teachers from across the state come there. And while they're there, they sign letters of resignation. Again, to understand, we hear now that, oh, it's illegal to go on strike in Florida, so that's why teachers don't go on strike. But it's also important to remember it was illegal for teachers to go on strike back then as well. And so what they do is they think they have a workaround. It's in effect a strike, but they sign letters of resignation, so it's technically a walkthrough, a walkout, not a strike, right? That they're going to resign from their positions and walk off the job. But the recognition is, we are going to hold this meeting. We're going to sign these letters of resignation just to scare Kirk. We're not going to go through with it. And even at the time, Phil Constance, the FEA president, and Pat Tornillo, who I think who's the famed and infamous at times former executive director and field secretary of the United Teachers of Dade, and he has this reputation of being this firebrand militant. He's actually calling for caution as well. So Phil Constance, the executive secretary of the FEA, and other union leaders such as Pat Tornillo are telling teachers, the time is not now, right? That we need to be cautious. Constance even invokes Martin Luther King and says, we need to turn the other cheek, but we're holding this meeting to show our power. Look, we just mobilized over 27,000 teachers to come to this meeting. We've mobilized that. We can show the state that we can put the education system at a standstill if we have to. And what they're asking for at this point is for Kirk to call for a special legislative session. Well, actually, it's first to create a task force to improve education, like of teachers, FEA officials, and even business leaders, to come up with ideas to improve education, and then to call a special legislative session to improve tax funding. And so they do that at the Tangerine Bowl meeting. They sign these letters, even though they're getting this message of patience from their union leadership.
Apologies for interrupting Jody Knoll here, but I want to play a quick audio clip to give you an idea of what teachers were feeling in 1967. This is from June Pittenger. She was the president of the Classroom Teachers Department of the Florida Education Association. And she spoke to how teachers were feeling after the Tangerine Bowl meeting, and kind of puts away the normal analysis of a strike like this, where the leaders of the union are really pushing for the most belligerent action. This was very much not the case in 1967.
They were very angry at that time. The teachers in the schools were way ahead of us. If we were the leaders, they were ahead of us because they had had more than we had had maybe, and they didn't want to mess around. They thought it was time for us to take the steps that were necessary to do whatever we could to turn the state around.
Now, back to our conversation.
And once they do that, it actually seems like a strike is about to happen. And you have a little couple of localized wildcat strikes in the fall of 67, one in Pinellas County and one in Broward County. And at some level, those are kind of test cases to see what this is going to look like, even though the FEA is not necessarily fully backing them. They are looking at what's going on these local strikes as well. But the Tangerine Bowl meeting, I think, is this incredible moment of solidarity. The other important, really important thing to understand is that this is an integrated work action. Most of the schools in Florida are still segregated, but Florida becomes the first state in the South to integrate its teacher organization. The FEA merges with the Black Teachers Association, the Florida State Teachers Association in 1965. So they become the first statewide organization to integrate. So, and then actually the UTD is the first teacher organization to integrate. They do it in 1963. And so you can see Miami helping to lead this as well. But so the point is though, like if you look at the Tangerine Bowl meeting, this is often the first time you have white and Black teachers coming together for the first time and meeting and talking with each other. So it's this recognition that it's not just the white teachers. We have to have all of us together in order to exert our power. And the Tangerine Bowl meeting, I think, becomes this really big wake-up call for everybody in the state that if we don't actually do something, then these teachers will go on strike.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
So you mentioned the idea of an integrated response on the part of the teachers of Florida, and in doing some preparation for the episode, something that really struck me is the hub of the strike in Dade County, to kind of bring in a little bit more local now, was the Miami Marine Stadium, which was constructed by Ilario Candelario. It's the architect in the early 1960s, and so it's a relatively new facility, and it's a landmark facility for Dade County, really signature piece of building, still stands on Virginia Key today. And there are efforts to restore it, but it's been in disrepair basically since the 90s. But its location is significant because Virginia Key was the home of the segregated Black Beach in Dade County. And from the Marine Stadium, you can see Virginia Key and also see basically the rest of the waterfront in central Dade County around downtown. And there were multiple examples of teachers kind of having that moment of recognition when they were at the Marine Stadium, realizing that this was a real change. Again, we're talking, February of 1968. This is, weeks before the assassination of Martin Luther King. This is a real turning point moment in the civil rights movement. But like you say, that's where civil rights and labor and society writ large kind of all combine, and power of politics and all that comes together. So the teachers ultimately decide to follow through on the threat to resign, and these letters of resignation are submitted, and you then have, again, like you alluded to, not technically a strike, but a strike. Technically a strike is not allowed, but you can't fire me for striking. I quit is basically the attitude. And how does the state of Florida respond to this? You had the special session that you alluded to, where basically the teachers were offered a bunch of half measures, and they felt probably correctly that they were going to bear the brunt of whatever the tax burden, the backlash, whatever the tax burden was going to be. Why in February 68 does this happen, and how does the state of Florida respond?
Yeah, so they have Kirk does end up holding a special legislative session He actually calls for it at the end of October of 67 because the teachers say we're going on strike unless you call for this special legislative session. And so they think there's this 2 month period where they say, well, maybe things are going to work out. It seems like Kirk is working with us. Then they hold the special legislative session and everything just falls apart. The legislature requests, I think, $250 million in extra funding to go towards education, in the name of education, which will also lead towards tax increases. But most of that money is actually going to be allocated in different places once you kind of read the fine line of that stuff. So the FEA deems that this is not necessarily an acceptable solution, but it does seem like at some level they are willing to work with it. That is until Kirk says that he is going to absolutely refuse to sign that law into, or sign that bill into law, that he will veto it, that he's not raising taxes. He campaigned on no raising taxes. He's had the no tax pledge for a year now. And so he's just saying, I'm not going to do it. So the plan is not adequate enough for the teachers, and Kirk is refusing to implement it anyways. And so that is when the teachers on February 19th decide that we have no choice. They haven't listened to us. They created a plan that we don't think is adequate enough. And even if we thought it was acceptable, the governor is refusing to sign it into law anyways. And so we're not going to actually get any improved funding or any of the demands that we're making. And so they send in their letters of resignation on February 19th, which leads to the first statewide teacher strike in the history of the United States. And it's black and white teachers. And I think one of the more fascinating things about it, and you see it in my book, is that I don't necessarily focus on any one specific county. I'm trying to tell stories of all of it, but that was at some level a conscious decision because I wanted to show the statewide nature of the strike. You have teachers in every single county. It's hard to find the data. I think Taylor County is the only county that didn't have any teachers, which is up in the Panhandle, the only county that didn't have any teachers go on strike. But what's fascinating to me is Dade County has a large number of teachers who go on strike. More liberal areas have a large number of teachers who go on strike, except for Broward County, but that's because Broward County is under a court injunction not to strike from their 67 localized strike. But if you look at more conservative areas of the region, specifically in the Panhandle, looking at the Pensacola region, looking at all of those counties, those actually have some of the highest percentage number of teachers who actually go on strike, which shows that it doesn't, like, political regionality does not play a role in this strike, right? Because oftentimes you can break Florida up, right? You've got the kind of ultra conservatives of the Panhandle and North Florida. Then you have rural conservatives of North Central Florida, except for Gainesville, right? Which is, the university town and kind of this blue city and a wave of red. And then the further south you get more and more Democratic strongholds, although those kind of coalitions are starting to break down in modern and today's Florida as well. But the strike, I think that is just one of the more amazing things is how it doesn't matter the political traditions or atmosphere of the teachers themselves, that they're all going on strike throughout the year. And in fact, I think, Dade County, in comparison to the rest of the state, is actually doing pretty well in terms of their education, funding and pay. I mean, I'm not saying that education was good in Dade County or, the support for it, but I think that they were doing better than a lot of the rest of the state. And I think from my research, you see a lot of teachers from that area saying we had to go on strike, not necessarily for us, but for the rest of the teachers across the state. And so it's just this huge moment. But they recognize that public opinion is going to play a fundamentally important role. And so it becomes this fight between Kirk to gain public support. And the teachers largely fail at that. They fail at that for a few reasons. I think, remembering that Kirk was elected By a pretty high percentage of people who supported his ideas. And some of his biggest ideas were not to allow unions into the state, really kind of anti-labor, anti-union ideas. I think a lot of people up until the strike actually were supporting the teachers. And once they went on strike, they lost that support. And I think a lot of it has to do with kind of, the Midwestern and Northerners who are embracing a more Republican ethos, which is very anti-labor, very anti-union at this time, and then the traditions around the state of being anti-union play a role. Although black newspapers and black newspapers is where you really see media support for the strike. You have the Jacksonville Sun-Times, which is a historically black newspaper, come out and say, this is our moment. You need to keep your kids out of school. We need to shut this system down because we need to support these teachers at all costs. The Miami, I can't
Miami
remember the name.
Times.
Yes. Takes a bit of a more moderate stance. They're not saying to support the strike, but they are more supportive of the teachers than you would see in more traditionally white newspapers, such as the St. Petersburg Times, the Miami Herald, the Orlando Sentinel. And the media really turns against the mainstream white media really turns against the teachers, where you see them supporting teachers throughout, and then they're fighting. And then once the teachers go on strike, they're just like, this is awful. We need to, these teachers are shirking their duties and all of that stuff.
I think what's interesting, what you bring up too, is Kirk emerges in 66 as, this Republican figure kind of sweeping in after the infighting of the Democratic Party. But he really does, I think probably what certainly helps him, and you alluded to it, is he's able to hit on the one thing that had organized Florida politics from the conservative Democratic side to the Republican side, and that's anti-unionism. And so it is very much a headwind, an extraordinary headwind that FEA and AFT and the locals are facing in doing this. But after a few weeks, there is this compromise that struck. And as you alluded to, Pat Tornillo and Mary Dean in Dade are kind of central figures in kind of maintaining organization in Dade, and these meetings that take place at the I almost said the Seaquarium, same island, wrong building, at the Marine Stadium are kind of critical in doing that. And the negotiated settlement that comes out of it is, I guess you would call it kind of a win with a bit of a poison pill. I think that's probably maybe being a fair recollection. It's certainly not a loss for the union, but it's not an absolute win either. If you want to talk a little bit about why is that the compromise that gets struck, how does this benefit teachers in Florida, and maybe how does it constrain them?
Yeah, so at the most historic, most analysis of the strike at the time, and then the few forms of historical analysis of the strike outside of mine has looked at it as actually a loss for the teachers. I don't think that is true at all. In fact, I think in one aspect, they gain maybe one of the most important labor victories in the history of Florida and the United States, which is the gaining of collective bargaining. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But the strike really comes to an end because teachers are just exhausted. After 3 weeks of being beat down by the public and just hearing, how they're shirking their duties and not getting paid, they are now looking for an out. They're basically saying, we have done this. We've showed our arm. We've showed our strength, and it's just not resonating. In part because they can't close. They don't ever succeed in shutting the schools down, which was their main goal. Instead, Kirk just places unqualified substitutes. Could be anybody, a parent. There's accusations that he's using active military members in the classroom, and so they have these substitutes who are not teachers, and there's tons and tons of letters to Kirk, to Floyd Christian, who's the head of education in the state of Florida, from students, especially who are saying, you keep saying that you're keeping the schools open, but the schools aren't open, right? I mean, we're just in here with these people who don't know how to teach, and they're basically just doing crowd control and not doing a good job at that. But the teachers, I think, throughout the state are pretty exhausted by this point. And it's also important to remember that it was a really difficult decision for many of them to go on strike. It's pitting them against some of their coworkers. It's pitting them against the state. They are worried that they might lose their teaching certification and not be able to teach in the state anymore. I did an oral history interview with a principal who went on strike, and he mentioned to me in Volusia County, William Bottoms, and he mentioned to me that when he decided to go on strike, his wife was out of. Was not, she was a teacher too, but she was not working because they just had a kid and they were still paying, in his words, paying the child off, right? The hospital bills. And then he goes on strike and that income, there's no income there. So I think that are going in, and there is, there's some strike funds that are being developed. The NEA gives it, but it's just not enough. And I think the teachers are exhausted by this point. Because really the strike lasts for 3 weeks. And it extends in other places, but roughly 3 weeks. But in reality, they've been fighting this battle basically since 1964. So they Phil Constance goes to the negotiating table with Kirk. Kirk at the time is using the strike and his ability to break the strike to increase his political image. He's hoping for a vice presidential nomination from Nixon at the time. I think Kirk has been largely forgotten by history, but from 66 really to 1969, his last year is largely ineffectual. He's him and Ronald Reagan, I think, are the two most important Republicans, Republican governors or local officials. They're the two rising stars of the Republican Party. David Halberstam calls, the famous author, calls Claude Kirk the most important Republican in the country because he's the man who's going to deliver the South to the Republican Party. So Kirk is trying to use the strike to his advantage, which I think is helping him nationally a little bit, but really hurting him at home as well. So he's recognizing that he needs to end the strike as well. And so they come up with a compromise, which is they're going to add, I think, roughly $10 million to the rest of the school year budget, and that Kirk will allow the $250 million budgetary increase, as well as the tax increase, which becomes the largest tax increase at the time in the history of Florida, to become law. And so the FEA and the teachers say, okay, we weren't necessarily supportive of this, but Kirk has now actually agreed to sign it into law, and we see this as a win. And so I think that those things are a big win. I mean, basically forcing, a governor who has campaigned on or who has run his tenure as governor as he's not going to raise taxes, but also as he is the man who can break strikes, not allow union control to occur in the state. He is, and that he will never negotiate with them, essentially. They've forced him to negotiate. They forced him to, he never actually signs it into law, but he doesn't veto it. So thus it makes it into law, right? So he can kind of have that victory. But the consequence is Claude Kirk, as governor, oversees the largest, at the time, the largest tax increase in the history of Florida. And so those things are really, really important to the end of the strike. But even after it, the teachers are kind of looking at it as a loss themselves, and I think they're pretty despondent. But what is also happening at the same time, and this isn't a part of the negotiations, but it is fundamentally important to understanding the consequences of the strike, is that they're rewriting the Constitution. The legislature is rewriting the state constitution. And because of the strike, as well as a few other labor actions by sanitation workers and fire workers, firemen, they say, well, we have to figure out how we're going to deal with public sector. The public sector workforce. And they give them the state constitutionally protected right to collectively bargain, which is now in the state constitution. At the time, Florida was the only, it's still the only state in the South that has collective bargaining rights for public sector employees. And it was the first state to make that collective bargaining rights a constitutionally protected right. A state constitutionally protected right. On the flip side, in the Constitution, it also says that public sector employees do not have the right to strike. But as I consistently remind people, they didn't have the right to strike in 68. They basically called the state on their bluff and said, "You're already in a teacher shortage. What are you going to do? You cannot replace us." And everybody sees that teachers are not replaceable. Like, we, even to this day, I think, people who haven't taught think that teachers are replaceable until they actually step in into the classroom. I think one of my favorite stories is Robert Cade, who is a professor of chemistry at the University of Florida and is the inventor of Gatorade. He is not supportive of the strike. He goes on a leave of absence from the University of Florida to become a substitute teacher. And he has these interviews where he says, "Well, yeah, classroom control is something that working with graduate students, I never really thought of before." And he never goes on to support the strike, but I think Dr. Cade, like, if you read the oral history, he goes on to appreciate what teachers, K through 12 teachers, have to go through every day. So I personally think, and I argue this in my book and all of my writings, that with the collective bargaining agreement in an anti-union state, in the South, it helps lead the way for collective bargaining to kind of occur throughout the country for teachers' unions. I think that it really ends up becoming a monumental victory for teachers. And the United Teachers of Dade, led by Tornillo, really run with collective bargaining. And I would argue become probably one of the most powerful unions, not just in the state of Florida, but throughout the country, in the 1970s and the 1980s. And it's because of collective bargaining. Now, it is also important to understand that collective bargaining does not happen immediately, in 68, even though it's put in the Constitution and the Constitution is ratified by the people of Florida. There's tons of lawsuits from the FEA and the AFT about the no strike clause, and then there's also lawsuits from anti-union opponent or anti-union advocates about the collective bargaining agreement. And collective bargaining isn't upheld by the state Supreme Court until 1974. But I mean, Florida, if we kind of look at it even to this day, Florida's the only state in the South where teachers can actually have a union and a collective bargaining body agreement. And that doesn't just apply for teachers, right? It applies for all public sector employees. And so it's why you see graduate students at the university level being able to have really kind of robust negotiating abilities, professors, firemen, policemen, any public sector worker. And that is a consequence of, or that is because of the strike. And so I think if we look at the strike 55 years later, roughly 55 years later, I don't see how you could say it's not a massive victory with a little bit of the poison pill as well, as you said. But I really do think that collective bargaining is just, it's a transformational moment for the state of Florida.
Yeah, I would agree with you wholeheartedly there. The last thing I want to get to before we wrap up is kind of, and you started getting into it a little bit in your answer there just a moment ago, but what are the long-term effects for the state of Florida, for Dade County, of this strike? You've had a lot happen in the field of education in the state of Florida since 1968. You've had, the reform movement ascendant with the election of Jeb Bush in 98 and significantly stronger Republican control since then. You've also had protest movements by Florida educators, the Wear Red for Ed movement, and really bringing pressure on Governor Crist to repel efforts by the legislature to institute further reforms in 2010, if I recall correctly, that kind of brought his political career to a halt. He would eventually be elected to Congress from the Tampa Bay area, but as a Democrat. So it definitely kind of changed his political trajectory. Where do you think we still see the echoes of 68 in Florida education today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still there. Florida in the 80s, I think, had the union was relatively powerful even then, in the 70s and the 80s, and it was building up, and they were able to really thwart off. I mean, one of the immediate consequences of it was Kirk isn't reelected. And so you see this kind of wave of red state Republicanism in Florida and the South, in the late 60s and early 70s. But then Kirk is such a confrontational bully, that it leads to an ineffectual leadership style, and they kind of reject him in 1970. And so Kirk doesn't win re-election, and then you have Democrats in the governor's mansion until Bob Martinez's election, who I might add, and was a part or led the Hillsborough County Teachers Association on their strike. And then he switches to the Republican Party in the 1980s, and this kind of famed story that Dr. Gary Mormino, who's at the University of South Florida, emeritus, has heard him say before, where Ronald Reagan comes down to meet Bob Martinez and says, something to the effect of, he's trying to woo Martinez to the Republican Party, and says something to the effect of, we have one thing in common. We have a lot in common, but the one thing we really have in common is we were both union men and we both left the union. And so I think that, speaks to that. But, the broader legacy is that you see Florida, I mean, Florida was, in terms of education in the 60s, was really failing and falling apart. And I think that they began to build up an infrastructure for a much robust education system. And they used collective bargaining for that. And they're able to maintain continuing contract and teacher tenure until 2010, or no, well, I guess 2012, when Rick Scott takes office.
Yeah,
And they're able
I
to,
think it was 14, 15.
14, 15.
Yeah,
Yeah. And
somewhere
so
around
they're
there.
able to maintain that up until then, which is constantly under attack. They're able to avoid merit pay until then, which is constantly under attack. You see broader movements. United Teachers of Dade becomes wild. I mean, they owned a radio station. They owned what was referred to as the United Towers of Dade, which I'm still trying to look into, but I guess they just sold it recently, which was an entire apartment building on Miami Beach that initially
No,
was
it's
the.
actually on Biscayne Bay in
Oh, was it
Brooklyn.
really? That's fantastic. That was initially used to be like a retirement home for teachers. But it was clear that they had an idea to make this like a political hub as well, because there was at one point where they wanted to try and get a polling precinct in there for elections. It's just a fascinating story, and Tornello is just a fascinating person in general. You mentioned the Marine Bowl. I have this one anecdote which I just found amazing is, during the strike, him and Janet Dean really want to exert their power or show their power, right? So they have a meeting at the Marine Stadium. And Tornello says in his memoir, he says that him and Janet Dean took a boat over the bay to the Marine, and that was their entrance to show this kind of great entrance. And then Kirk had to one up them because he was never one to be upstaged. And he takes a helicopter to the meeting because it's a meeting with Kirk and the teachers and everybody. Now, Tornillo says that Kirk steps to the stage, says, "How many people are over 50?" Nobody stares. They just stare at him. And Janet Dean steps up and says, "I'll help you, Governor. How many pe teachers over here are over 50?" And they all raise, all of them raise their hands and actually respond. And she turns around and looks at Kirk and says, "Okay, the audience is yours. Do you have anything to say? Any more to say?" And Kirk gets angry and leaves in a huff without ever actually saying anything. I found a couple of newspaper articles that say Kirk actually did say a few things, right? Tornello paints this very vivid picture, because he's, Kirk does say a few things, but the effect is still the same. They basically boo him off the stage. He gets walks back with his tail between his legs and gets on his helicopter. And so I think people saw that and saw the power that they could have, because Kirk is this tough-nosed person, who constantly says that he scared H confronted H. Rat Brown, who is this black militant in the 1960s who's coming to Florida. And Kirk, so he just has this image of like, I'm never going to be shut down, I'm never going to be bullied. And I think that image right there, I think, plays a large role in education in Florida for a really long time. I have no I The interesting thing about CREST, because I think that's, first you have Jeb Bush with the education reform movement and standardized testing and all of these things. And I think that's when you begin to see the increase of like business style efficiency and accountability bleeding back into education. So Florida, again, is a leader in this, right? Like they're helping to kind of lead the charge for these new education reform movements. Charter schools, school vouchers, all of these concepts, Florida becomes a leader in this. And yet, they do find opposition to it, and that's the legacy of the strike. Now, CREST actually vetoes the teacher tenure, the anti-teacher tenure and merit pay bill in 2010. And the reason he does this is because teachers are forcing him to, right? I mean, I was in undergrad at the time, and I just remember Actually, I think I had just started working on my work on the strike for my undergraduate honors thesis. And I just remember being rather amazed at the political mobilization of teachers and exerting their power over Chris, because he knows that this is going to end his run as a Republican when he does it. Like, there's no doubt that he knows that. But there's just so much pressure on him that he doesn't really have a choice. And the other thing that I've always kind of wondered is his father was actually on the school board of Pinellas County during the teacher strike. And I've always wondered if that influenced his decision as well, because he saw firsthand, I think he was in high school at the time, he saw firsthand the power of these teachers, because it was affecting his father's position. His father is a doctor in St. Petersburg, because he was affecting his father's position as a because the strike was affecting his father's position as a school board member. And so I always have wondered how much that influenced. I have no idea if it did or didn't, but I think the bottom line is that Florida teachers do have a lot of power. And despite the constant barrage of trying to strip them of that power, and I think it has succeeded in a lot of ways. They still do maintain that power, and there is this kind of legacy of a strike, the strike there, that I think is fundamentally important, and it's a history that I want all teachers in Florida, but all Floridians, to understand from that as well. But teacher militancy is hard. It's hard to get, as you see with the strike in 68, it's almost impossible to get full-on public support to have a prolonged teacher action. And so it makes it difficult as well.
I when I describe to people doing the work that I do, and I work mostly with high school students, so I'm not working with the little ones quite as much. But I did middle for 6 years, and when people ask me about like, oh, you're in the union and what's it about, I'm like, it's a really hard thing to do because teaching attracts suckers. We're suckers for our kids. We're suckers for their achievement. And so when you're trying to be a tough-nosed SOB in negotiation, you do recognize that leaving the classroom would have a negative impact on them. But I think the big thing in 68, and when you see teacher movements, and we saw the wave of teacher strikes in the United States in the 2010s, elsewhere, starting in West Virginia of all places, it is when teachers feel that is those children that are being negatively impacted, that's when they get their dander up. That's when, not when the pay thing, everyone, the pay is a joke and everyone knows it forever. That's not going to be the breaking point. The breaking point is when, like you said, you're working on textbooks that are 20 years old, or you're working in facilities that are failing, or the air conditioning isn't working in South Florida and it's 90 degrees outside and the kids are sweltering and passing out. That's the breaking point. And I think that's what you saw in 68. I think that's what you saw in 2010. And I think when you see it again, whenever it will happen, because it will happen again in Florida, it will be over that, and the pay will be part of it, but the pay is always there. But it's when the education experience for children is being compromised that teachers get most get their hackles up.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true, right? We talk about emotional compensation, which leads to the suppression of teacher wages, but professions of care, right? Because teachers do care, right? I mean, they are, I always say that they are experts in their field, but they are going into it because they care, and they care about the children, right? And so you see this kind of concept of emotional compensation being used against teachers and nurses and other professions that care, that had professions of care, I guess. And that you're absolutely right. I think that really does lead to the most form of militancy, is when it becomes that they don't feel like they can adequately do their job. I mean, I feel like teachers, my wife is a assistant principal, both my parents were teachers. It's her first, my wife was a teacher for 10, 12 years, and it's her first year being an assistant principal now in an elementary school. So I understand the lot of teachers very well. I think that you're right. It is going to happen again, especially as we continue to erode it. But you kind of see it You're seeing an uptick of activism throughout the country as well, I think. And I think you're beginning to see it more and more in Florida as well, especially as they feel like maybe some of their students are under attack with some of these policies, especially, the policies of DeSantis. They feel like their academic freedom, which has always been under attack, especially as standardization has occurred, right? But as that's increasingly under attack, I think we're gonna see more and more because it's what affects the students is what affects the teachers the most, like you said.
For sure. The book, The 1968 Florida Teacher Strike, Public Sector Unionism, and the Fight Against Sunshine State Conservatism. It is part of the Making the Modern South series from the LSU Press. The author is Jody Baxter Knoll. Jody, thank you so much for, I cannot wait to dive into this even further with what you wrote. And having you on to kind of talk about your work has really been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me today and for what you do.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for what you do. We need more teachers in this world.
Thank you. Again, thank you so much to our guest today, Jody Baxter Knoll, a lecturer in history at Georgia State University and the author of the book, The 1968 Florida Teacher Strike, Public Sector Unionism, and the Fight Against Sunshine State Conservatism. Dr. Knoll has done some work on this strike before this longer version in the book, and I'll share some information about the work he's done in the description of this episode. It's really fascinating stuff to understand, not just Dade County's history, because Dade does play a really significant role in this strike and how labor relations change in Florida, but obviously also for the entire state. I also want to thank LSU Press for sending a review copy so I could dive into this thing and understand it a little bit better before its release and inform my discussion a little bit with them. The Wolfson Archives, as always, pulled a couple clips from their archives for this episode, always so essential to everything we do here. I also want to thank you in the audience for listening and caring to learn about our unique history down here in Dade County. So again, please make sure you follow us on social media at This Day Miami Pod. Pretty much every major social media platform, Facebook, Instagram, we're on Blue Sky and Threads too. Make sure you find us there. ThisDayMiamiPod.com. You can find our website and our store that has our most recent merch there, the Interama t-shirt. Got some positive feedback on that, which I appreciate, and just a great way to support the show. Until next time, I've been Matthew Bunch.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.